This is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 852169, St. Francis College versus Majid Gaidan Al-Khazraji. Mr. Fiskus, you may begin whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case involves issues similar to that present in the prior discussion and started by the filing of three complaints in the Western District of Pennsylvania by plaintiff Dr. Al-Khazraji, charging various offenses under the civil rights laws of the United States. I go into the detail only because there is some question as to what the pleadings here actually raised, and therefore you have the question as to the kind of charges that were in fact made. My brief sets forth the allegations in the various complaints here, and I would note that the operative complaint, as viewed by the district court, did not charge any racial discrimination, but charged discrimination on the basis of national origin and religion, and that therefore the question then becomes whether or not an Arab, under the facts here, would be treated as falling within the scope of Section 1981 of Title 42 in a situation when, in fact, there was not a racial allegation made. Now, I should say, in all fairness, that District Judge Ziegler, who had handled the case before it was reassigned to Judge Mentzer, had read the various pleadings more broadly than Judge Mentzer did, and more broadly, apparently, as the Third Circuit did in this particular situation. But the fact remains that the operative complaint, as I think it was read by both Judge Ziegler and Judge Mentzer, was really the second complaint, the one filed by prior counsel for the plaintiff here, and that complaint basically restricted itself to a national origin and a religion complaint, not a racial one. However, the issue here seems to be premised on the notion that, in fact, a racial complaint at least could arguably be read into the complaint. That seems to be the basis upon which the Court granted certiorari in this case, and therefore, other than mentioning the limitations on the actual pleadings, which is a fact that the Court might take into consideration, I will then deal with the argument as to whether or not Arabs do fall within the scope of Section 1981.
What did the Court of Appeals hold?
The Court of Appeals, Your Honor, held here that Arabs do fall within the scope of Section 1981.
Well, so the race issue was rather than national origin, was before it.
Oh, yes, indeed it was. I mean, at least the way that the Third Circuit interpreted the factual situation.
So we're reviewing a judgment of the Court of Appeals, I'm not sure the pleadings have got much to do with
well,
it.
Well, Your Honor, the point about getting into the pleading history and what have you is that The various pleadings are some indication that from the beginning, the plaintiff here has been viewing this as a national origin claim, and that Arab, at least initially, and to some extent, has been characterized as being in the national origin category.
Well, the Court of Appeals said, went on the racial ground, didn't it?
Yes. But I'm discussing this in terms of, to use the phrases that were used previously, the...
So you will discuss it on a racial ground?
Yes, I am. Yeah, yes, I will, right. Your Honor. Okay. Yes. And my position is really a rather simple one in this case. The statute basically talks in terms of white citizens, and it seems fairly well admitted by the plaintiff himself in the deposition that he gave that he qualifies as a Caucasian, i.e., that he is, in fact, racially white. The charges of discrimination are presumably that he was discriminated against in relation to other people who are racially white. And our position very simply is that in that kind of a factual situation, a claim under Section 1981 is not made. I mean, it really comes down to that. He's admitted in the deposition that he does qualify as a Caucasian, i.e., a person who is racially white. The statute has been construed by this Court to apply on a racial basis, not on a national origin basis, not on a religion basis, not on a sex basis, and therefore, once the plaintiff, in essence, admits that he is a Caucasian, and when his purported complaint is that he was discriminated against in the denial of tenure in relation to other Caucasians, that a claim is not made under the statute.
Well, he doesn't have, in his allegations or in his proof, the things that are in the prior case that was argued.
Absolutely.
Namely, that he was discriminated on the grounds of race because that was the intent of the people who fired him.
There is absolutely no evidence in the record, to my knowledge, Your Honor, that there was any racial animus at all in terms of the decision that was made.
Or that the decision was made because they thought that he was of different race.
That is correct, Your Honor. No. My recollection of the record is that there is absolutely no evidence in the record at all to indicate that. Now, I will say in all fairness that there was very limited discovery in the matter.
Well, and so his argument, you say, is that he claims to have been discriminated on the grounds of race, but concedes he is not of a different race.
That is correct. That is basically what we end up having here, because the presumed discrimination was in relation.
How did the Court of Appeals come to such an error then?
Your Honor, all I can do is read the way the Court of Appeals dealt with a racial issue and defined it as being membership in a group that is ethnically and physiognomically distinctive, and that presumably would ignore the admission of the plaintiff that he in fact was a Caucasian and was presumably discriminated against in relation to other Caucasians.
Well, ethnicity, that may be different than race, isn't it?
I would submit it is, Your Honor. And going back to the discussion in the earlier...
You say the Court of Appeals applied the statute too broadly if it applied it just to ethnic groups.
I would suggest that it did, Your Honor, yes. That the language used in the statute talks about white citizens. It does not talk about various ethnic groups. And that, therefore, I would submit that ethnic groups or national origin claims are not within the scope of Section 1981, and that essentially is what the plaintiff is arguing in this case.
Well, you say ethnicity is different from race. It is nowadays, but it was not in 1866.
Your Honor, I have read the references to the Congressional Globe debates that are cited.
Never mind that. The dictionary definitions that are set forth extensively in the briefs.
Your Honor, I would submit that that is irrelevant, that the critical thing is that the statute is in terms of white citizens, and the contrast, therefore, to have a discrimination claim under 1981 has to be in reference to white, which is a racial characterization, and that you cannot contrast that and treat Germans or English or Greeks or Italians as being people within the scope of the statute.
Even though they thought they were doing something about race in the sense that they understood race at that time.
If the Court please, I do not think that the legislative history is anywhere near clear enough to indicate that that, in fact, is what the 39th Congress had in mind whenever they were going through the debates on the Civil Rights Act of 1866. I mean, I do not dispute that there were a number of references in the legislative history where what we now call ethnic groups were characterized as races, but there's no real indication, as I read that history, that in fact there was a clear intent that those people be included.
I think it's clear that what they meant by race is something quite different from what we mean by race. I think that's absolutely clear, not just from the legislative debates, but from the dictionary definitions at the time.
Justice Scalia, even if that is so,
a stock of people, whether it was ethnically distinct or not.
Oh, Justice,
but
I'm sorry.
I think the other point you're making, I think, is worth pursuing, and that is, does white person imply only color, or does it mean race?
Well,
you say it means just color.
Color in the racial sense, at least.
Color,
right? Because otherwise we start getting into the situation that we then start looking for 1981 purposes at the individual shades of the purported plaintiffs and then start deciding what degree of darkness or lightness, depending on a particular situation, we're going to say is sufficiently distinctive so that we're going to get involved in saying that we're making out a Section 1981 claim because the purported favored group is dark and the purported aggrieved group is light, or vice versa. And I would suggest that the characterization in the statute, because of the use of the term white, does not include ethnic groups, even though there were some discussions during the legislative history, and even though the dictionary definitions indicate that the term race may have had some meaning beyond or was used in other than the racial sense in which we use it today. The fact is that the statute was not written that way, and I would submit that if Congress had in mind the notion that all these various ethnic groups were to be covered, there would be the much broader language could have been used than was used in the actual statute. I mean, actually, the interesting thing is if you look at the legislative history when they start talking about the different kind of ethnic groups and they're described as race, it so often comes up in the question of they're really talking about the legislatures having power to discriminate by saying that Germans, for example, are not allowed to own property and things of that sort. And in some ways, we go back to the earlier discussions that the Court had as to whether the statute, in fact, covers private claims of action. I mean, the decisions of the Court have determined, of course, that it does, and so we have to operate on that premise. And you also run into the generalized disagreement that the Court has had over the years, whether the Civil Rights Act of 1866 and the reenactment in 1870 were in fact designed to deal solely with the freed slaves and the people in the South, rather than the broadened scope that has since been given, so that it now apparently covers discrimination against whites, at least vis-a-vis people of other races. But those decisions have been reached, and unless the Court is prepared to find exceptions to those or overrule those earlier lines of cases, we have to face the fact that this Court has already decided that the scope of the statute goes beyond the mere protection of blacks, which was one of the earlier positions that was taken. But in light of the history, I would suggest that it would be inappropriate for the Court to go beyond the broad categorizations and extend the reach of the statute to, in essence, start covering ethnic groups or nationality groups or national origin groups, which is the suggestion that is being made here. And there,
if this person was denied tenure to make room for an Asian, say, he could take a good claim under McDonald.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Or to make room for a Negro.
That too would be correct under McDonald.
Well, how do we know what the facts are here?
Well, the only thing we have in the record at this point is that the only other person granted tenure
was a white person.
Was the plaintiff's wife, and she was granted tenure 2 years after he was turned down for tenure. I mean, the record, other than that, has no evidence in it as to what occurred as far as the granting of tenure is concerned.
But his claim is that he was discriminated against because he was ethnically different.
The way the Third Circuit apparently has read.
Well, his claim must include discrimination based on ethnicity, on his different ethnic character, because he concedes he's not a different racially.
That's correct, Your Honor. His claim essentially is that he was discriminated against on the basis that he is an Arab who was born in Iraq.
Yes, but may I ask you, he doesn't just limit it to ethnic differences, but at least the Court of Appeals, ethnically and physiognomically distinctive.
Well,
in other words, one of the two elements of their test, as I understand it, is some kind of inherited characteristic that is visible physically, that you can see people are maybe 8 feet tall or something and also from a particular country.
Justice Stevens, that is correct as far as the Third Circuit is concerned. That is not necessarily part of the complaint of the plaintiff.
No, but in order to prevail under the Third Circuit's theory, which we're reviewing, he would have to prove, as I understand it, that he was in a separate ethnic group and a separate group that was physiognomically distinctive from the general population.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
So, I mean, it's those two ingredients that are part of their test.
Yes, if you treat that as a I always get confused, as an and rather than as an or in terms of the requirement that both be present, that would be
and correct. They would therefore fit into the point that Justice Scalia was suggesting earlier, that a given stock is subject to prejudice. If you're of a particular national origin, which also has particular physical characteristics that make you identifiable, and then that group as a whole is subjected to discrimination, you fit this test.
If the reading that Justice Scalia is giving it is the appropriate one, then I think what you say does follow. I don't see how the answer could be anything other than an affirmative.
It wouldn't necessarily cover every national origin claim. You might have two countries in South America where the people are not physiognomically distinctive, but yet they might be different from the population at large in the United States.
I suppose that might be true, Your Honor. I'm not totally sure. But if you read it as requiring that both be present, that it be genetically part of an ethnically and physiognomically distinctive subgrouping, then presumably you would need both to be able to make a claim out. Now, how you end up making it out and the kind of proof that would be required and what you would end up charging a jury or the standard that the district judge would use in terms of fact-finding, I would not presume.
Well,
that
the Third Circuit wouldn't protect Germans on that basis.
Well, it might.
Well,
I suppose it might decide, or a fact finder could decide, that German is an ethnic group and that there are some physical characteristics that are uniquely enough belonging to Germans that one could end up saying they've been discriminated against under this particular test.
Or Irish.
Same thing with Irish. I mean, presumably every ethnic group, one way or another, at least in one way or another, someone could end up saying they have physiognomically distinctive characteristics that fit within the stereotype of a particular ethnic group.
Like Swiss, they yodel.
I mean, essentially, without rehashing what was said during the first argument, that essentially is our position, that there are really no precedents of the court that would include the plaintiff here within Section 1981, that the statute itself should be read the way I have suggested that it should, and that a claim here, which is essentially a national origin claim, does not fall within the scope of the statute. If the court has no other questions, I would be prepared to go on and discuss the retroactivity issue. Again, the position on the retroactivity issue is really a rather simple one. This court decided in Wilson versus Garcia that in Section 1983 cases, the personal injury statute of the various states would be used to decide the scope of the statute of limitations for Section 1983 cases. The Third Circuit concluded in the Goodman case that the two-year statute would be applied and that it is being applied in Section 1981 cases, which is what is present here. The question before us is how we would apply the retroactivity standards of Chevron Oil versus Houston. As I read the recent decision of this court in the criminal retroactivity case that came down not too long ago, there's specific language indicating that that case is limited to criminal cases and not to civil cases, and that Chevron is still the standard to be applied in civil retroactivity cases, which is what we have here. I really have two simple arguments in regard to the retroactivity. One, that the proper scope is not necessarily the degree of certainty within a particular circuit, but that considering the wide-ranging divergence of views as to statutes that were to be followed in the various circuits through the United States in the application of statute of limitations under the Federal Civil Rights Act, that no person could reasonably have relied on any particular statute of limitations, and that therefore the onus was on plaintiffs to, in essence, go for the shortest potential statute in a particular jurisdiction.
Do you think it's permissible, Mr. Fisfis, to go circuit by circuit on this retroactivity business?
Your Honor, obviously, if the court concludes that it is permissible, then it can be. My suggestion is that it really should be done on a national basis. If you do it on a circuit-by-circuit basis, then I would suggest that as of the time of the accrual of the cause of action here, for the reasons basically set forth in the brief when I discussed the Davis case and the way the Pennypacker case had been decided previously, that it was nowhere clear that a six-year statute of limitations rather than a shorter statute of limitations was going to be applied. That those cases, if you read them carefully, simply were not clear-cut enough so that one could say that in all 1981 cases, regardless of which of the particular subdivisions of 1981 was going to be applied, and regardless of the type of case involved, that there was going to be a six-year statute applied rather than a two-year statute. Therefore, without getting into the convenience factor and the notion that full retroactivity here gives a much greater degree of certainty than attempting to go through the procedure that's been happening since Wilson versus Garcia came down with this myriad of cases in the circuits trying to decide how much certainty was there, how much certainty was there not, that the certainty aspect would in fact be enhanced by determination that full retroactivity is appropriate. But in any case, that if you go through the Pennsylvania cases, that is the Third Circuit cases interpreting the status of its decisions on how the statute of limitations was to be applied in Section 1983 cases, I suggest to you that there was no certainty upon which anyone could have relied, and that in any case, the 1978 amendments to the Pennsylvania statute of limitations statutory scheme completely reopened the door anyway, and that the Third Circuit in Its own cases basically indicated that the 1978 amendments cast substantial doubt on the statute of limitations aspect of Davis. Davis is specifically mentioned by the Third Circuit, and yet in our case, the Third Circuit relies on Davis as indicating that certainty was present as far as the retroactivity is concerned. I'll reserve any further time I have unless the Court has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Fisfis. We'll hear now from you, Ms. Mitchell.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please this Court, we are asking this Court today to decide whether Section 1981 of the Civil Rights Act of 1866 covers those of Arab ancestry. We premise our argument on two very important points. First, the meaning of the word race, as we use it today in 1987, is not the same as those legislators used it in 1866. That is correct, Your Honor.
You tell me how you get the word race to be relevant to the meaning of white person.
Your Honor, we look at the term race because one of the things that was happening about the time that the 1866 Act was passed was that in the 1830s there was an influx of Irish and German. These waves of immigrants created some severe problems for persons in states such as Ohio, who believed, as advocates of the American nativist movement, that the Irish and the German were not fit to live with those of the Anglo-Saxon race. A prominent Know-Nothing tract published in 1854 indicated that Irish and Germans were not of the type of quality of person that we would want dwelling with those of the Anglo-Saxon race, and openly advocated discrimination against those people.
Right. Now, you're going to get to answer my question?
Yes, Your Honor.
I believe all of that, but the way to combat that would have been to use the word race in the statute. Now, they did not use the word race in the statute.
That is correct, Your Honor. The legislators...
So the dictionary definitions you should have given us were the dictionary definitions of white instead of the dictionary definitions of race.
Your Honor, Senator Trumbull, who was the author of the 1866 legislation, spoke to the purposes of the 1866 legislation, and in that legislative history indicated that one of his objectives was to make sure that persons of all races and colors and previous conditions of servitude had equal rights under the law.
And that's the only thing you're going to rely on to get us to believe that the word white person in the statute means race.
Your Honor, the concept of race was a generally understood term for the legislatures in those days to use in the sense that we now use the word ancestry. To the legislators in 1866, race meant ancestry. Senator Merrill, in the case, indicates...
Mr. Mitchell, I don't think you're understanding me. I believe all that. I believe all that. I'm with you on that point. But the word race does not appear in the statute.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
So of what relevance is it then?
It is relevant because this Court has indicated in several decisions that it is a racial character of rights that 1981 was intended to protect. We look back at the 1866 Act to see what the meaning of race was in the minds of those legislatures in 1866, and it was a far different definition. Those legislators believed that by covering various races, they were covering the Swiss, the German, those of the Scandinavian race, those Moors and Turks, and some immigrants who were yet to come to the shores.
And the only evidence that white person in the statute means race was the one snippet of legislative history you just quoted.
No, Your Honor, there are...
And you say later decisions of ours, which say it's...
That is correct. I believe that your later decisions looked at the 1866 Act to see what was meant by the term race, which to this day has not...
Term race is not in the 1866 Act.
That is...
How do you get around that?
Your Honor, we look at the decisions of this Court.
Well, how did this Court get around that?
Your Honor, this Court has never addressed the issue. This Court has never defined race for us.
The statute.
Well, Your Honor, if this Court has held that 1981 is intended to protect against racially motivated deprivals of the right to contract,
all citizens are all persons are declared to be born here are declared to be citizens, and such citizens of every race and color
are intended to enjoy equal rights under the law. Yes, that is correct.
Well, the word race is in the statute.
That is correct, Your Honor. And if we go from that premise...
What did the statute mean by white persons? Who were white persons?
Your Honor, the word white was not a term of art in 1866. Anglo-Saxon was the term of preference. The legislators were unanimously Anglo-Saxon. They intended in their definitions in 1866 to characterize the Anglo-Saxon race as the one to which all other races aspired.
So white persons meant white Anglo-Saxon Protestants? What?
Your Honor, the term Anglo-Saxon was used as the ancestry which was most favored in the sense of the 1866 legislators, and it was this exact problem, the problem created by the Know-Nothing Party, that certain legislators intended to correct under the 1866 Act. They said that if Ohio shall pass an act which denies to a German citizen the right to contract...
Yes, but stop for just a minute. Did white person mean Anglo-Saxon? Is that the short definition?
In 1866, I believe that it was. For the additional reason that in 1866, immigration into this country was very severely limited to only races such as the Germans and the Irish in the East and the Chinese in the West. One of the problems facing the legislators of 1866 was that there would be discrimination against Chinese, there was discrimination against Irish, there was discrimination against Germans, and the 1866 Act was intended to give to all men equal protection.
The appeals judgment here.
I am partially defending it in the sense that
you mean
they
you're
indicate,
not defending it in totally, is it?
I am not defending their definition, Your Honor, for this reason. I believe that ancestry in the minds of the 1866 legislators meant race. I believe that the 1866 Act is intended to protect those of different ancestries. The Third Circuit held that an Arab, an ethnic Arab of Arabian and Iraqi ancestry, could pursue a claim under Section 1981. We agree with their finding, but we believe that the test that the Third Circuit used has some very severe problems for this court.
The test, it was what?
Their test is that one who is ethnically and physiognomically different may maintain a claim under 1981.
And you don't agree with that test?
We suggest that the proper test is that one who is of an ancestry viewed as a different may maintain a claim under 1981. We believe that if you were to use the ethnical and physiognomical test, you would get the federal district courts into looking at the physiognomical characteristics of people.
Viewed by whom? By the defendant? I mean, suppose I don't like the McCoys.
Pardon me?
I'm a Hatfield and I don't like the McCoys.
That's correct.
And I view all McCoys as bad. I don't care where they are. If they have the name McCoy, they're bad. Now, is that...
No, Your Honor, because they are not of a distinct ancestral group. Our definition...
Who decides who's a distinct ancestral... I think they're a distinct ancestral group. I think all McCoys are McCoys.
Your Honor, then you're into the subjective type of discrimination.
That's what I'm trying to get at. Is it subjective? If it's not subjective, where...
No, Your Honor,
you have to know who the real McCoy is.
That's right.
Your Honor, our test...
That's what I was leading up to, right?
Well, I'm not, and you're probably not. The ancestral test, Your Honor, is an objective test. It looks at whether the ancestry of a certain people is one which... has been viewed as distinct. For instance, the Jews have a certain ancestry.
How easy does that ancestry word make it much easier? You've referred to the Scandinavians as a one ancestry. Now, could a person of Norwegian extraction bring an action against someone of Swedish extraction for discrimination?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The point is that if you are discriminated against because your ancestry is Norwegian, you have a cause of action under Section 1981, regardless of whether the perpetrator
in spite of,
is...
In spite of the fact that Norway and Sweden were one country up until 1905?
Your Honor, that makes no difference to us, and the reason is that country of origin is not a good test for that exact reason. If this...
Well, then how about someone of Bavarian extraction suing someone of some other German area?
Your Honor, if there is discrimination because of the ancestry of the person, if a college refuses to tenure Germans, believing, for whatever reason, that they don't deserve to be tenured because of an ancestry.
What about discriminating against somebody because he's a son or because she's a daughter of a felon?
Your Honor, that is not ancestral discrimination, in our opinion. Ancestral discrimination, as defined by the ethnologists in the 20th century, relates to the culture from which your forebears came. There is, in fact, a Jewish culture, a Scandinavian culture, an Irish culture, a German culture.
What if I don't like people who were born in Rhode Island or the Rhode Island culture?
Your Honor, I don't believe that ancestry takes into account your state as being one of the covered categories.
Well, if it can take into account someone born in Bavaria, why can't it take into account someone born in Rhode Island?
Because the common perception is that Rhode Island people are not of different ancestry than Pennsylvanians.
Well, but that just answers the question by defining it.
Well, how about somebody born in New England as compared with somebody born in the Deep South?
Your Honor, I don't believe that that is the type of ancestral discrimination that we want to cover under our test, nor was it the type of ancestral discrimination at the 1866
Act. It may make
Act.
A lot more sense than, say, Swedes and Norwegians.
There's a lot of discrimination against Yankees in the South and probably against Southerners in the North. Why wouldn't that be covered?
Your Honor, the ancestral theory relates back to what was in the minds of the legislators in 1866. The legislators in 1866 clearly considered race as meaning ancestry. The fact that we use the term race today to mean the five divisions of mankind as proposed by modern ethnologists does not make any difference.
Ancestry means forebears, and all of these questions that have been put to you say, what about this kind of forebears? And you speak as though you have in mind something much narrower than just forebears when you use the term ancestry.
Your Honor, I am trying to avoid a country of origin definition because I think country of origin is a very difficult thing. I think that you can be traditionally viewed as Irish, whether your ancestors are the Irish Free State or whether they were born in Belfast. I think that this Court does not need to address that precise issue. The ancestral definition that we propose looks to whether your forebears are of a different subgroup.
You didn't like McCoys either. And you know, that's why I picked McCoys, because they are all of a common ancestor. I mean, that's, you know, they all have the same name. They're all from
but
the
they state. Are not of the type of people that the 1866 Act was intended.
Oh, that's your second qualification.
That is a second.
It has to be an ancestral group that the Congress in 1866 would have identified as a race.
That is certainly one workable definition, Your Honor, but then we get to the...
What does that mean? Is that what you're proposing? That it has to be, number one, an ancestral group, and number two, a group that the 1866 Congress would have said is a race?
We can look to the 1866 Congress usage of the term race to see what they meant.
I know we can. Are you going to answer my question? Is that the test you're proposing? Number one, ancestor, and number two, it's a group that the 1866 Congress would have considered to be a race.
That is the test that we're
That's the test you're proposing.
And then you have to prove that they thought about the Persians as a separate race.
Your Honor, I think that there is enough language in the 1866 Act to suggest that those legislatures did view as separate races those coming from those discrete geographic areas which are perhaps now known as countries and perhaps not.
Let me just get one thing clear in my mind. You are not defending the Court of Appeals' second element, physiognomically distinctive. You want us to change that definition. And you did not file a cross-petition for cert.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But you want us to, in effect, broaden the definition that they applied because I suspect maybe you have concern about whether your client can satisfy that element of the
No, that is not correct, Your Honor. Your Honor, my client and his physiognomy would be viewed by the Third Circuit as the type of physiognomy entitling him to maintain.
Case, you say the Court of Appeals was just wrong in its test, although you won under that test. You say, please don't adopt that test. Use this one. So if we agree with you about the Court of Appeals but disagree with you on your test, your client's going to lose.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that this Court can refine this notion of physiognomy.
That isn't much of a refining. You just reject the Court of Appeals test.
Your Honor, I reject it in part. insofar as the Court of Appeals test suggests that ancestry or ethnic origin is part of the foundation for proving your 1981 claim, that is certainly a workable and usable definition that these courts can utilize. I am not in favor of a test which would require a federal district court to look at the physiognomy of a person who comes in and indicate that if you have slanted eyes, then you are entitled to pursue your claim because you're probably Oriental. But if your eyes are not slanted enough, then how can we conclude that you are entitled to sue? What would happen to Mr. Justice Marshall's father if we use a physiognomy test as part of the ethnic origin or ancestry test?
My father, what would you do for somebody from South Africa?
That is precisely the issue.
What would a resident of South Africa be classified as?
Your Honor, under the modern-day classifications of race, residents of South Africa are not classified at all. The modern-day definition of race adopted by the EEOC...
You mean they don't exist?
That is correct, Your Honor. There are vast groups of people who do not fall within...
What difference do you make between the people from Nigeria and the people from Sierra Leone?
Your Honor, the people from Nigeria are Caucasian because there is a portion of Caucasian...
I've never seen one look like a Caucasian.
Precisely. That's the point, Your Honor. The point is that if we use a dictionary definition of Caucasian, we have Middle East Caucasians who are Arab.
Incidentally, I thought Caucasian were from the Caucasus.
Your Honor, the original definition in 1854 was that it was a resident of the Caucasus Mountains between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea.
What Caucasus are you from?
Your Honor, not from any right now.
But you're a Caucasian.
Beg pardon, Your Honor?
But you are a Caucasian.
I am of what the EEOC has called the white European subdivision of the Caucasian race. We also have North African persons who are usually black, residents of Libya, who may in fact be Jews. We also have the Hispanic Caucasians who are Mexican. If you believe the petitioner's argument here, Hispanic Caucasians cannot sue because they're Caucasian. Arabs who are Middle East Caucasian cannot sue because they are also Caucasian. They may have a different skin color. They may be ethnically and physiognomically different under the Third Circuit's test. They are certainly ancestrally different under our test, which we propose to this Court today, but the fact that they are Caucasian under some modern ethnological theory thus means that they are not entitled to sue under Section 1981. We cannot believe that this Court should use that as a definition. We cannot believe that the federal district courts here should look at one of 50 dictionaries to see whether a Syrian is a Caucasian or is...
Well, you wouldn't mind if you wouldn't mind us saying that, I suppose that as far as the Third Circuit went, it was right.
If you choose to affirm the Third Circuit, Your Honor, my client would be very happy, but that is not our theory of the case.
Well, I know, but you certainly don't argue that if a person is ethnically identifiable and has these physical characteristics, that you shouldn't discriminate against.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor.
Well,
exactly,
you just want to argue some other case. That's all. You just object to the fact that the Third Circuit seems to have limited the coverage to those characteristics.
My particular concern with the
Third
Circuit...
Well, isn't that right?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
Well, you want to argue somebody else's case.
Well, Your Honor, what I am attempting to do is...
And so if you would be very happy, I suppose, if you said, we just don't reach the question of whether the statute's any broader than that. We know we were urged to do so by... counsel, but we just don't reach it. We don't have to.
You do not have
we
to.
We just leave it open.
That is
leave
correct,
it open.
Your Honor.
You ought to be happy with that.
Well, the issue, Your Honor, I think...
Well, maybe you think the Third Circuit's test is so implausible that we're so unlikely to adopt it that you're trying to suggest one that would win for your client that is plausible.
Your Honor, I believe...
Maybe that's what you're trying to do.
I believe that the theory that we have suggested to this Court, the ancestry theory, is one which is much more workable in the federal district courts as a threshold question for persons advancing a 1981 claim.
Well, I think the Third Circuit's test is subsumed in yours.
Part of it is, Your Honor. That is correct.
Part of it? Why?
Ms. Mitchell, aren't you really suggesting a sort of national origin?
Your Honor, the national origin question is a very difficult one that we need not address first of all.
Well, isn't that what, at the bottom of it all, your test amounts to?
Your Honor, I believe not. And I believe that if a person, for instance, who is Armenian of ancestry, is denied a right to contract because they believe he might be a terrorist, that if we use a national origin test, he loses because Armenia is not a country. If we use an ancestral test...
How can discrimination against Arabs because they're Arabs rather than Caucasians be anything but a national origin sort of a test?
Your Honor, we believe that it is a test that most properly focuses on the fact that those of Arab ancestry are, for instance, traditionally disadvantaged, viewed as different,
of
a different
culture.
Well, if it
looks like a national origin test and sounds like a national origin test, is that what it is?
It may be a national origin test. The problem that we have,
though, is...
And then what
do we do with Jones, which says that doesn't get covered under the statute?
That is correct, Your Honor. But I believe that it will
so
be...
So that's why you want to avoid calling it a national origin.
That is correct. That is precisely
even though
that
it
point.
Looks like a national origin.
In part, it looks like national origin. But our position is that if the court looks to the ancestry of the person, as the 1866 Act suggested, that in fact... Not only is our client an Arab, able to maintain suit under 1981, the Jewish members of Shara Tefillah Synagogue will win their case because ancestrally they were perceived to be a different group. Whether or not they believe themselves to be a different group is not of issue. The issue is that ancestrally Jews were discriminated against because of their culture and because of their ethnicity, not because they were or were not advocates of a certain religious tenet.
When you say were perceived to be, you don't mean by the people who committed the acts, you mean by society.
By society at large. Not a majority definition and not a minority definition, but by members of the society.
You wouldn't have us look to modern dictionaries to figure out what's a race. You would have us look to old dictionaries.
Your Honor, I suggest that looking to any dictionary is going to give you 50 different answers to the same question.
And well, how do we find out whether society at large considered, Jews is probably an easy question, but I don't know, Swedes. How do I figure out whether society at large considered them a separate race?
In 1866, the answer is very clear. In 1987, the answer may not be so clear, but if one uses the ancestral theory of discrimination, Swedes are of a separate ancestry. If they are discriminated against because of that ancestry, then they have a right under 1981 to redress.
Now, your question regarding Justice Marshall's father leads me to believe you were here during the earlier argument.
That is correct, I was.
What would your answer have been to the questions I was asking about whether the intent to discriminate has to be specifically directed to a dislike of the race as opposed to a dislike of some characteristic which one thinks people of that race or of that whatever you want to call the group happen to share?
Your Honor, my answer to that question is that if a group such as Jews is discriminated against because of their ancestral characteristics and beliefs, they have a right under 1982. It is not founded on their religious beliefs. It is not a measure of whether subjectively the neo-Nazis believe that the Jews, because of their religion, deserve to be discriminated against. Our test doesn't
work. What about the question I asked whether if I think Italians or French or you pick the racial group, I think they're sloppy and therefore I don't want to rent, I will not rent an apartment.
Then I will sue you under Section 1982.
I think it's not that I hate the French. I have nothing against the race. I just don't think they make good tenants.
I believe that you have discriminated, and it is covered under Section 1981.
But you would give a remedy to some person who discriminated against someone because he was from Sweden, but the person says, well, I know the Swedes are not of a different race at all. I haven't any racial animus against them. I just don't like Swedes.
Your Honor, whether the belief is mistaken is not at issue. Whether they were right or wrong in believing a certain ancestor
you would say that if that plaintiff was well advised, he would know that he really is discriminating on a racial basis within the meaning of the statute.
That is correct. That is correct. We cannot use the subjective intent of the parties as our touchstone of whether there has been discrimination. If we have a smart neo-Nazi party, they say, oh, we don't view Jews as a separate race, and we're discriminating against them because of their religion. And therefore, we are not going to suffer an award in the Federal District Court of attorney fees and punitive damages. We're going to have our state remedy. Well,
of course, it could be that there is racial retaliation or racial violent religious conflict. That could be, but that wouldn't be covered by 1982.
Well, it would be covered by 1981 or 1982 if the belief was an ancestral belief that Arabs are terrorists or that Jews are inferior. It is not directed at them because of their Muslim faith or their Jewish faith. It is directed at them because of what society perceives to be a difference between their culture and the cultures of other people. I would like to address one question that Justice Stevens raised in the Shara Tefila argument. You asked, did the people who passed 1982 think Jews were a separate race? Our answer to that question is yes. They did believe that Jews and Swedes and Irish and Germans were a separate race, and we advocate here today that the 1866 Act was intended to cover that perception, that ancestral use of the term. With the Court's permission, I'd like to move to the Chevron aspect of my argument. My argument there is, first of all, that the Third Circuit was correct in holding that under Chevron considerations, the claim under 1981 was timely filed. I will call to the Court's attention one fact. The author of the decision in the Third Circuit, Judge Stapleton, was also the author of the 1977 case Davis, which was the case relied upon by litigants to believe that there was a six-year statute in the Third Circuit. We believe that Judge Stapleton correctly interprets the law of the circuit in that regard. Should, however, this Court find that it would be appropriate to apply a two-year statute of limitations to 1981 under Wilson, we ask that this Court remand our case to the District for consideration of the equitable estoppel arguments. These arguments were raised both before the District Court and before the Circuit, but need not have been reached by either of those courts in reaching their determination. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Mr. Fisfis, you have 6 minutes remaining.
If the Court please, I'm going to just take about 30 seconds only to reply to the last matter on the remand. And may I suggest that if the Court looks at the chronology of events, the discharge of the plaintiff was in May of 1979, well before the statute of limitations, the two-year Pennsylvania statute of limitations would have run. If that one is the if the Court treats it as retroactive, and therefore anything that anybody may have said to the plaintiff about not doing anything and going through internal processes would not really have made any difference because he still had plenty of time to file within the two-year period. So there's no basis for equitable estoppel in the situation, even if you believe the allegations in his affidavit that certain statements were made. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisfis. The case is submitted. We'll resume at 1 o'clock.